Good morning. May it please the court, Judy Fulmer Madewell on behalf of Christopher Fuentes. Mr. Fuentes pleaded guilty to being a felon in possession of a firearm. At sentencing, over his objection, the district court increased his offense level by 2 levels based on the offense having involved 3 firearms. On appeal, Mr. Fuentes argues that the district court clearly erred in applying the adjustment because the evidence was insufficient to establish that he possessed the 3rd firearm. The firearm stat guideline 2K2.1 allows for an increase to the offense level based on the number of firearms involved in the offense. if there are 3 to 7 firearms involved, the increase is by 2 levels. That's under 2K2.1B1A. The commentary to the guideline says that in calculating the number of firearms, the court must count only those firearms that are unlawfully possessed. Possession can be either actual or constructive. Here, the issue is whether Fuentes constructively possessed the 3rd firearm.
Right. It's undisputed that Fuentes lived in the house.
No, it cannot. That is very clear from this court's case law, which I cited in my brief.
He did live there.
Yes. Oh,
with,
yes.
With others.
Yes. Yes.
And Ainsworth did not live there.
No, he did not. He did not. He has listed a separate address, but we don't know how long he was staying there.
But there was a rifle in plain view in the house to which Fuentes had access.
I would dispute that characterization of facts, Your Honor. There was a rifle in the front small bedroom at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Leaning up against the wall.
In a corner of the room, leaning up against the wall at 3 o'clock in the morning when the officers entered. They entered pursuant to a search warrant, busted down the front door, went into the hallway, and saw Fuentes heading into the back room to the right.
So somebody was awake at 3 a.m.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Someone was awake at 3 a.m.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, someone was awake at 3 a.m., Your Honor. Yes, they saw him going into the back right hallway. They followed him in there. He ran in, went down on the floor, was reaching under the bed, and they stopped him. They found a firearm under that bed. After they detained him, they went through the house. In the middle bedroom, they found Vladimir Tejeda and a woman. And then in the front bedroom, front small bedroom, they found Clayton Ainsworth and the firearm propped up against the wall in the corner. They then found in the living room, John Joe Sanchez and another woman. At that point, they also searched a car that was on the premises and they found a firearm in that car. At the time that he was arrested, Mr. Fuentes admitted that the firearm in his bedroom and the firearm in the car were his. He received a 2-level increase based on those 2 firearms plus the 3rd firearm that was in the front bedroom that Mr. Ainsworth was in.
But you can have joint possession, right?
Yes, Your Honor. You can have joint possession. But when you have a situation where if someone exclusively occupies a premises, then any item found in that premises, their exclusive occupancy can be sufficient to establish constructive possession of the item in there. If there are multiple people occupying the premises, the same conclusion does not apply. There has to be something more. And what this court has said that something more is, there must be evidence that the defendant had knowledge of and access to the firearm. And it is the government's burden to establish the evidentiary basis for that adjustment. And we don't have the evidence here.
The government's got to show it to a preponderance.
Yes.
Right? And then on review, we have to say what he found was plausible. Is that correct? That's where we have to conclude that what the district judge held as to knowledge and access is a plausible finding.
You have to determine, my understanding is, whether he clearly erred, whether he abused his discretion in making that finding.
That's a hard burden on appeal.
I mean, when you look
at... Yes, Your Honor. When we're under clear error review, that is a more difficult standard on appeal.
What's somewhat more compelling in favor of the court's finding here is your client's statements. First, if I'm not mistaken, he did, whether mistakenly or not, say 2 of the guns in the house are mine. Then he tried to say they didn't have bullets, but he had them to protect his home because it's not disputed that he was a gang member and he'd been broken into several times. He was terrified about his family. So he goes on at length to the district judge claiming the guns. Now, you can say that was just a mathematical mistake, but he refers to two guns in the home. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor. You are correct. In fact, in the plea hearing, initially, he even refers to rifles.
Okay.
However, the defense attorney clarifies immediately that he is only
at the plea hearing.
But
then at the sentencing, he goes back to the two guns in the house, and the court says, what you're saying just doesn't make sense, because he says he's got them to protect and use, but then he doesn't have bullets in them. It's a very confusing allocution.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's one of the reasons why my client's statements don't provide sufficient evidence
to determine that.
And I'll use an example. In the case of Houston, in this court's case of Houston, the defendant there during the pre-sentence report was talking about how his wife had been subject to rape. And
but
said,
Houston is a husband
pistol.
And a wife, and the gun's in her purse. Here it's an admitted gang member who's admitting he's got guns to protect that home from rival gangs, right? Wouldn't you find a notebook that said the notebook in there, a manifesto to this Latin gangs group?
I don't believe that he was admitting that he had the guns to protect the gang. I believe he was admitting that he had the guns to protect himself.
Because they were dealing drugs out of the premises.
The district court did not find.
I understand that, but there were
the evidence of drug trafficking.
They didn't happen to find it. You're right about that. But
the district court did not make that finding that there was drug trafficking.
But it's just not husband wife, right? He's a fugitive. He admits openly, "I am a fugitive."
And in fact, Your Honor, to some extent, the idea that a husband would have knowledge of a wife's gun in her purse while they're traveling together would seem to be more of a fair inference than. There are three separate people who live in this house. There are three separate people, and the Almighty Latin King's notebook was actually found in Mr. Tata's room. So my client's not the only gang member here.
But when they come in, he's diving for his gun.
And
this other gun is propped in open view. It just really sounds like they all know they've got guns everywhere, and then he admits to the judge, "We did. I was protecting things."
I dispute that the gun was in open view. It was in open view in that bedroom, but there is no evidence that the bedroom door was open. In fact, the officers, when they entered that house, they entered by the front door.
How big is
that bedroom?
House? A thousand square feet?
Your Honor, I don't.
Well, Cincinnati, what part of town is it?
It's by St. Mary's Law School.
So
I don't know if that actually adds anything.
Well, I'm from San Antonio. There are not a lot of large houses.
No, they are not. They are
so
not large
So it might have
houses.
Been at most 1,800 square feet.
Well, when the officers entered the house, they entered by the front door, and this was the front bedroom. And if that gun had been in open view, I suggest that those officers would have secured that weapon immediately, but they didn't. They went down the hall, probably not a long hall, but they went down the hall and followed Mr. Fuentes into his bedroom where he was getting his gun. He admitted at the time of his arrest, the gun in his bedroom, the gun in his car. Look, he did not admit to the gun in the front bedroom.
May I, since you're using up a lot of time here, may I move to the idea of harmless error, even if there is clear error here with because the district court clearly says that even if the sentencing range is 37 to 46 months, I am giving you 60 months.
Right, but my guideline range is 46 to 57.
See, that, I don't understand how that helps you. When I read your report, wait a minute here.
You can't be much clearer than that.
Except for the fact that his reason for giving the sentence he did was he must get more than 4 years, which was what he got on his last case. 36 to 47 month range, there is no 4 year sentence or greater within that range.
But you know,
he sentenced within what he believed was the guideline range. The guideline range, the correct guideline range.
But he sentenced to five, not four.
That is correct.
And it was way more than.
But the standard that this court applies for harmless error review is that the government must convincingly demonstrate that the sentence imposed was not influenced in any way by the guideline error, that the district court, when faced with the correct range, which I argue is 46 to 57, would have imposed the same sentence for the same reasons, which would represent an upward variance.
He did refer to the factors of 3553, didn't he?
He said the word 3553. He said, I'm going to impose an alternative sentence. I believe that's called what? A 3553. That was the district court's
I understand,
comment.
But, you know, I mean, at some point we have to take district courts at their word. Otherwise, remand is useless.
Well, Your Honor, this court also said in Johnson that we take them, that when we do this, when the court does this review, we look at what they actually said. We don't speculate of what they might have been thinking or what they could have said or what other reason would support the sentence.
I know, but
they
the whole
gave.
Point, well, the whole point of... Well, okay, we understand your position.
But my point is, if he just wanted a four-year sentence, he could have selected 57, and he didn't. He picked 60.
That is correct. That is correct. But it still does not show that if the court had believed the correct guideline range was 46 to 57, that he would have selected an upward variance to 60 months. And that, under Ibarra Luna, that is the standard for reviewing harmless error. Would the district court, faced with the correct guideline range...
What my point is, your correct guidelines is higher than the correct guideline. He said, look, even if we're looking at a 30-something...
A lower guideline.
A lower guideline. He said, I'm going up to 60. So there's no reason to believe that had he picked an intermediate guideline, that he would have gone to something less than 60, because he departed from that alternate guideline way up.
What he did was he sentenced, he believed 57 to 71 was correct, so he sentenced within guideline. He said
but
in the
he
alternative.
Said alternatively,
right.
It's a much lower guideline, I'm upward departing.
Because there was no sentence within that guideline
but
that was greater than 40. I understand the argument, Your Honor. I disagree that under Ibarra Luna and the standard of review that the court applies, that the fact that he didn't select bottom of the range, but selected slightly above, means that the error was harmless.
But he considered a lower guidelines and upward departed anyway, so.
Yes.
All right, we understand that, so have we omitted anything that you need to say? Have you omitted any?
I don't believe so, but
I think it's pretty fact-intense.
Yes.
Yes, you have rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Gay?
Good morning, may it please the court. I'd like to respond to this last line of discussion, because I believe the record does conclusively show, if you look at the very beginning of the sentencing transcript, Judge Beery starts off by saying that we're starting with 77 to 96 months if everything is included. Then defense counsel says we have an objection as to acceptance of responsibility. The judge says, okay, that means it would be 57 to 71. Then counsel says we have another objection. That objection is to the number of guns. Judge Beery says, okay, that'll be 46 to 57 months. Then, finally, there's an objection as to his absconding. And then Judge Beery says, okay, that would be a range of 37 to 46 months. That's on pages 2 through 4 of the transcript. He knows all of these ranges when he makes that comment. And he basically says, even at the very lowest, I still want to impose 60 months. In this case, under this court's precedent, I believe that the record does conclusively show that every intervening guideline the court was aware of. And it was the piecemeal way in which the objections were brought out that was clarified. And so in this case, there is absolutely no doubt that there was an alternative sentence under 3553 for 60 months. And the burden that appellant's counsel would suggest is applicable in this case would simply turn the whole concept of 3553 on its head, because almost in no circumstance could this court say that an alternative sentence had been imposed.
We sort of may have done that ourselves. If Ibarra Luna requires district judge somehow to see a different range and then say regardless, it's very difficult to find something harmless. And that's the world we're in. I'm wondering if this is the right vehicle, though, to correct it, because the district judge, at least in his statement of reasons, got confused by saying, well, his prior state sentence was 4 years. I want to double that, he said. There's a lot of confusion. So if you're urging us to reconsider Ibarra Luna, this is a very tangled vehicle to be persuasive to do so.
Actually, I don't, I'm not
You think arguing. We win under that?
Yes, I do, because I think that we can show that the court was definitely aware of the 46 to 57 range. There's no doubt. He actually says it. I'm aware of that range, and I choose essentially at the very end not to apply it. And he does say in the part of doubling, he says, I'm not going to do that in this case. He makes it.
But then in the statement of reasons, he goes back to that as his alternate reason.
His view was, and this has to do with recidivists and gang members, that if you don't get it with 4 years, maybe 8 years, maybe whatever will do the trick. And so he's sort of speaking off the cuff there that he believes that if you don't get it, you maybe need more time so that you do get it.
Did the defendant say at sentencing, two of the guns in the house are mine?
I believe he did, Your Honor. I had read over that. But getting back to that question, and I'll see if I can find that exact language. You pointed out that constructive possession requires evidence showing a plausible inference that the defendant had knowledge of and access to the contraband, the firearm in this case. The idea, it is his house, it's unequivocally his house. Ainsworth is simply there. He's not even an occupant of
the house. How big is the house?
I don't know, Your Honor, but I would speculate, based on our discussion, that as you know, the area where this house is located, it's probably a small house. But that said, the idea that somebody's going to bring a long rifle into your house and lean it up against a wall, is that just sort of the sort of common sense? And that's what plausible, I think, means, that we don't second guess under a preponderance standard. Is it plausible that gang members keep guns in their houses to protect their drug distribution activities? And while he wasn't charged with drug trafficking, there were scales found, baggies found. There's evidence, and marijuana, of course, that drug trafficking most likely would occur under a preponderance review. This is the sort of case where, number one, I believe that the district court properly found that the three firearms should be counted. And number two, and he even says, if I'm wrong, I still want to give him 60 months. And we do know for a fact that he was aware of this 46 to 57 month range when he imposed that 60 month sentence. So I believe we do fall under Ibarra Luna.
I think we have your argument.
Thank you very much, Cheryl.
Thank you.
I just want to respond really briefly on two points. Regarding Ibarra Luna and the court's concern that the case law is setting up a situation in where district courts can never get right. All I do is appeals in the Western District of Texas, and there are judges who set out alternative sentences that are unassailable on appeal. And one of the things that this court said in Ibarra Luna is, because in Ibarra Luna, the district court believed the range was 12 to 18. And he said, well, that's ridiculous. I'm not doing that based on this murder conviction that he's getting in Texas state court. And he's not getting enough time for it. I'm going to impose 36 months. But then on appeal, it ended up that the correct guideline range was actually 6 to 12. And the court said, though there's an indication the judge would have not gone with the 6 to 12 range for the same reason he didn't go with the 12 to 18 range, that it's not sufficient to show that he would have gone to the same sentence, 36 months.
But that's going the other way. It's going down, not up.
I understand the position on that, and that it is different factually from my case. But the court said the district court gave no further indication of precisely how it arrived at the 36-month sentence as to the appropriate term of imprisonment. So many times when district courts are selecting sentences, they will say, I am selecting this sentence. In fact, this is what happened in Bonilla and Duhon and Tizet Mejia, where the district court said, this is what I believe the range is. The range may be this. Regardless of what the range is, I'm going to give this sentence.
If they say that phrase, that works. If they say that phrase, regardless of any, they don't have to guess right.
But then they have to say, for these reasons, under 3553A,
actually,
as applied
in Bonilla,
to the facts
the court
here,
didn't do that.
No, it didn't.
It's interesting, Your Honor. I agree with you on that. Ibarra Luna describes it in that way, though in Bonilla, in actuality, it was in the guideline, it was in the pre-sentence report, and no one disputed that that was the appropriate, that was the other considered guideline
range. That was actually
range.
Hotly disputed.
Oh, I apologize.
From
my reading of the case law, and I was not personally involved in the Bonilla case.
I was on the panel.
From reading the subsequent cases, so there is, I don't believe that this court's case law has set up a catch-22 situation for the district court judges, and I submit my case is wildly unique, and it is very unlikely that this court is going to run into a factual situation quite like that one. Regarding the merits issue on the number of guns, opposing counsel said this was Fuentes' house. He was renting it with two other guys, so he was not the owner of this house. This house was being rented by three guys. The idea that it is implausible that somebody will bring a gun, in Texas, law-abiding people carry guns, and I submit that we have drive-by shootings in San Antonio because gang members carry their guns. So it's not implausible that Ainsworth brought the gun. It is not implausible that this bedroom was actually Sanchez's. There were three bedrooms. There were three guys renting. I don't know why Sanchez was in the living room with
the
other woman.
I think we're quite familiar with the fact. So if you want to summarize, if you have something to summarize, fine. We know
yes,
the
it's
fact.
It's the government. We don't have to show it was Ainsworth's gun. We don't have to show it was Sanchez's gun. The government had the burden to show knowledge of and access to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Court will take attention.